This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, June 17, 2009. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. President Obama reveals plans to regulate America's financial system. Civil rights activists say federal authorities are violating the rights of Muslim charities. And as protests continue over election results in Iran, the Islamic Republic accuses the U.S. of meddling in its affairs. All these stories and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. More than 2 months after an earthquake hit central Italy, killing 300 and leaving tens of thousands homeless, the government is still debating a plan to rebuild the region, FSRN's Diletta Varlese reports.
Yes, we camp shouted almost 1,000 people from the Abruzzo region as they demonstrated in front of the Parliament building in Rome. They are representatives of nearly 55,000 who were left homeless and have been living in a tent camp for 2 months. The camp lacks hygienic services and bakes in 95-degree heat of an early summer. The Abruzzo people say the Berlusconi administration has not kept its promise of a quick recovery. The only construction in the area is related to the coming G8 meeting, planned for the 8th and 9th of July. On Wednesday, Berlusconi toured Abruzzo by plane and met with local government representatives. Homeless residents say they are waiting for the G8 presidents to come and have a coffee with them at the tent camp. Diletta Varlese, FSRN, Brescia, Italy.
North Korea has once again threatened an attack if the U.S. and other nations continue to rein in their nuclear program, saying the technology is not a monopoly of the United States. In a statement released in a state-controlled North Korean newspaper, the government said, "If the U.S. and its followers infringe upon our republic's sovereignty even a bit, our military and people will launch a 100 or 1,000-fold retaliation with a merciless military strike." The renewed threats come shortly after President Obama and South Korean President Lee Myung-bak stood side by side in Washington to discuss ways to move forward.
North Korea has abandoned its own commitments and violated international law. Its nuclear and ballistic missile programs pose a grave threat to peace and security of Asia and to the world.
In addition to North Korea being labeled as a nuclear threat, the U.S. also considers the country a top offender when it comes to human trafficking. In a report released yesterday, the U.S. cites the economic crisis as a major contributing factor to the proliferation of human trafficking. Ambassador Louis DeBaca is the director of the U.S. Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking of Persons.
In a time of economic crisis, victims are more vulnerable, affected communities are more vulnerable, and persons who are under economic stress are more likely to fall prey to the wiles of the traffickers, who often get their victims through promises of a better life.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the problem is global.
Trafficking is a crime that involves every nation on earth, and that includes our own. Trafficking and forced labor are grave problems here in the United States. And we've been reminded of this in recent weeks, where authorities uncovered a scheme to enslave foreign workers as laborers for hotels and construction sites in 14 Midwestern states.
12 people have been indicted in that case, which actually involves trafficking in 14 states, from Colorado to Florida to Massachusetts. The U.S. House has approved controversial war funding legislation that includes a $5 billion credit line for the International Monetary Fund, with the intention that they use the money to help developing countries weather the economic downturn. The U.S. has pledged $108 billion in total to the IMF. The $106 billion bill now goes back to the Senate for final consideration. This week, Detroit is home to two national summits addressing the current U.S. economy and visions for the future. The national summit, convened by the Detroit Economic Club, featured the CEOs of Citigroup, Dow Chemical, and Ford. While attendees say the messages of the national summit have been positive, activists don't feel the meeting is addressing the real problems. In response, they've convened an alternative people's summit in Tent City, which continues through today. Sacagawea Hall reports from Detroit.
Activists in Detroit, joined by supporters from 10 different states, have taken over Grand Circus Public Park in the heart of the city around the clock as an alternative to what they call a big business summit. Chris Hamill, People's Summit organizer.
Well, I don't know anybody personally that can afford $695 to go to a summit in order to throw in their 2 cents about what our future should be. That's why we're having the People's Summit in Tent City, to have really the voice of those who are the victims of these people at the business summit.
On Tuesday, 200 people, the majority of them retired or laid off auto workers, demonstrated in front of the National Summit at GM headquarters. Organizers plan to address the needs of workers and the poor by developing a people's stimulus plan and economic bill of rights. Sacagawea Hall, FSRN, Detroit.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News from Eugene, Oregon. I'm Jess Burns.
Today, President Obama is signing a presidential memorandum that will give some benefits to the same-sex partners of federal employees. This comes as many members of the lesbian and gay community express their growing discontent with President Obama for not keeping campaign promises. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
Gay rights activist Rick Rosendahl has worked with the U.S. Department of Labor for 30 years. As a federal employee, he says benefits are definitely lacking.
Health benefits for partners of a gay federal employee, for the same-sex partner. And then there are survivor benefits, relocation assistance in cases where a federal employee is relocated.
But Rosendahl, who also works with the Gay and Lesbian Activist Alliance in Washington, D.C., says today's announcement by the president is a step.
The president deserves due credit for what he does extend to us today, and then we continue pressing for more.
That more is holding President Obama to what he promised on the campaign trail.
When I am president of the United States, gays and lesbians will have somebody who will fight for equal rights for them, somebody who opposes don't ask, don't tell, somebody who's fought to make sure that gays and lesbians aren't discriminated against on the job or hospital visitation, because they are our brothers and they are our sisters, and I don't mind everybody knowing where I stand, because that is why I meant it.
But since the start of his presidency, some have wondered if he will keep his promises. Recently, the Justice Department released a memo defending the Defense of Marriage Act. The act defines marriage as a legal union between one man and one woman with regards to federal law. It also protects the rights of states to decide on the legal recognition of same-sex unions. Carissa Cunningham, Director of Public Affairs with the advocacy group GLAAD, says Obama needs to make a move.
It's an odious, discriminatory law, which is responsible for the lack of benefits that federal employees have. The large-scale thing that he, and not to let them off the hook, members of Congress could do, is introduce repeal of the Defense of Marriage Act.
Openly gay Representative Barney Frank says the Obama administration has made a mistake in the Justice Department memo and is calling on President Obama to explain himself. Kevin Cathcart is the executive director of the civil rights advocacy group Lambda Legal. He says President Obama also needs to explain why it's taking so long to act on the military's don't ask, don't tell policy.
He's not a candidate now. He's the president now, and he's the commander in chief now. And he ought not to be allowing a policy that he disagrees with to continue wrecking the lives of people who are serving in our military, sapping the strength of the military. It needs to end.
Many anti-gay groups have predictably condemned Obama's announcement extending some federal benefits to same-sex partners. The Conservative Family Research Council, in a statement, questioned if President Obama has the authority to make these changes. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
President Obama revealed plans to significantly change regulation over America's financial system today. In a White House speech, Obama called for tougher regulations on large financial institutions. He also called for greater coordination between America's numerous financial regulators. Obama spoke about the current situation.
It is an indisputable fact that one of the most significant contributors to our economic downturn was an unraveling of major financial institutions and the lack of adequate regulatory structures to prevent abuse and excess. A culture of irresponsibility took root from Wall Street to Washington to Main Street.
One proposal that's expected to generate debate is the creation of a Consumer Financial Protection Agency. This entity would regulate financial products like credit cards and mortgages. Obama also wants to increase the Fed's power to oversee financial institutions like large insurance companies, whose failure poses a great risk to the economy. Banks would also be required to hold a minimum amount of capital in their accounts, and products that have gone unregulated until now, like hedge funds, would be brought under government oversight. Conservatives and financial interest groups are expected to oppose these reforms, arguing they could stifle the market's potential for growth. Obama tried to seek some common ground.
I've always been a strong believer in the power of the free market. It has been and will remain the engine of America's progress. I believe that our role is not to disparage wealth, but to expand its reach.
The president said his reforms would mitigate reckless lending and irresponsible borrowing. His blueprint for financial regulation will now go to Congress, and the administration hopes to have the reforms approved later this year. In the wake of three fatal shootings fueled by racial and religious hate, U.S. civil rights leaders have issued a report that details what they call a perfect storm of grievances for extreme hate groups in America. The report shows an increase in hate crimes against Latinos and immigrants, linking the rise to inflammatory anti-immigrant rhetoric in the mainstream media and on internet message boards. Matt Pearson reports.
Three fatal hate crimes in the past month have killed a U.S. soldier in Little Rock, an abortion provider in Kansas City, and a security guard at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. A new report issued by U.S. civil rights leaders tells us that hate crimes in America are being reported at the rate of about 7,500 per year. That's almost one every hour. Workers in the Latino community say they have encountered a rise in hateful attacks. Gustavo Torres, the executive director of Casa de Maryland, has been working to provide education and services to Latinos in Washington, D.C. and Maryland for 15 years.
For the last few years, we have been facing a lot of problems because the work that we do working with Latinos, they attempt to set fire on one of our locations in our worker center, as well as receiving threatening calls telling us that they are going to bomb CASA and to kill our vice president of our board, among other attacks that we receive in a daily basis.
The report says hate crimes against Latinos and those perceived to be immigrants have risen sharply in the past few years, as anti-immigration rhetoric in the media and on the internet has become increasingly hostile. It blames mainstream media providers for favoring the views of biased anti-immigration organizations such as FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform. Michael Lieberman, one of the co-authors of the report, says a number of factors have caused an increase in organized hate group activity.
The election of the first African-American president, a deep economic crisis, a broken immigration system, and faster, better means of communication among like-minded haters.
The report recommends a revisiting of hate crimes legislation that was introduced in Congress over a decade ago. Though the bill has had trouble before, Lieberman is optimistic that the new administration will make it a priority.
Unfortunately, this legislation has been around since 1997. It was under a veto threat from President Bush for 8 years. Now, with President Obama supporting it, with Attorney General Holder a strong supporter of effective hate crime laws, we have our best chance ever to get this bill enacted into law.
Eric Holder, testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Wednesday, offered his strong support for federal action.
I think the time is right. The time is now for the passage of this legislation.
The current hate crimes bill has passed in the House and is awaiting action in the Senate. Matt Pearson, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
The ACLU says that some government policies are restricting the rights of American Muslims to practice their religion. Some American Muslims are abstaining from zakat, or donating money to Islamic charities, because they fear U.S. authorities will investigate them for links with terrorist organizations. The new report says that many Muslim charities have been mistakenly targeted by law enforcement officials. Salim Rizvi reports.
Shortly after the September 11th terrorist attacks, the Bush administration implemented measures that affected Muslims across the United States, One of these was Executive Order 13224, giving the Treasury Department broad powers to freeze the assets of Muslim charities, even those that weren't accused of criminal wrongdoing or included on any government watch lists. Jennifer Turner is the author of the ACLU report titled Blocking Faith, Freezing Charity.
The Bush administration had its Treasury Department use laws that were intended only to deal with embargoes against foreign countries and use them in a novel way to close down American charities as part of the quote-unquote war on terror. I spoke with Muslims of many different backgrounds, but including South Asian origin, and many donors told me that they could not give in charity even to respond to a major event abroad. For instance, the earthquake in Pakistan, many donors told me they just felt that they couldn't make donations to support people in their country of origin who were suffering through that catastrophe.
The 162-page report says that the statutes were enforced in a discriminatory manner and violated the rights of Muslim charities. The result, a chilling factor in which Muslims across America remain afraid to donate to charities, an important religious tenet called zakat. The ACLU's research used interviews with more than 100 Muslim leaders and found that the government policies have created a climate of fear and distrust in law enforcement. According to the report, the U.S. government used secretive evidence and opaque procedures to shut down without notice 7 Muslim charities in the United States. 2 others shut down after the government used raids, surveillance, and bad publicity against the charities, which had not been listed as terrorist organizations or previously had assets frozen. While the ACLU admits there are links between some Muslim charities and terrorist groups, it accuses the U.S. government of using unfair and ineffective procedures in violating the due process of charities. The Treasury Department still has these sweeping powers, and some want these rolled back. Farhana Khera is the executive director of a California-based organization, Muslim Advocates.
We would also urge the president and the administration to revisit and look seriously at law enforcement activities that have been probing the charitable giving and associations of individuals.
During a speech from Cairo earlier this month, President Barack Obama promised to look into U.S. terrorism finance laws. Now, Muslims are waiting for the Obama administration to act and work with the Congress to remove what many say are discriminatory laws that target Muslim charities. The ACLU has issued a number of recommendations for the Obama administration to act upon, including the repeal of Executive Order 13224 and the issuing of 2 new orders, one that would require terrorist watch lists to be completely reviewed within 3 months. Salim Rizvi, Free Speech Radio News, New York.
Tune in to FSR on Thursday when Mary Trigona reports from Buenos Aires about a new study linking Monsanto's use of a herbicide to birth defects. Some are denouncing the study as politically motivated, while others call it a red flag. That's tomorrow on Free Speech Radio News. Protests continued in Iran today over election results that declared a victory at the polls for President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Today, about 100,000 supporters of opposition candidate Mir Hossein Mousavi held a silent protest through Tehran's streets. Human rights organizations are saying the government is repressing protests and journalists' freedom to report on the events has been significantly curtailed. President Obama spoke about this situation on Tuesday. Iran's foreign ministry filed a formal protest today against the U.S. government's remarks, saying the U.S. is intervening in Iran's internal affairs. The U.S. and Iran have already been at loggerheads over Iran's nuclear energy program. So how will the current situation in Iran change the difficult relations between both nations? Reporter Rose Katapchi spoke with Rebecca Griffin of Peace Action West. Her organization has been working toward nuclear disarmament since the 1960s and more recently has focused on promoting diplomacy between the United States and Iran.
Rebecca, I know in your organization you are trying to push diplomacy around the nuclear issue. So is Iran a nuclear threat?
Well, obviously, our organization as a nuclear disarmament organization doesn't want any country, including the United States, to have nuclear weapons. The evidence that's available from the International Atomic Energy Agency, from the United States' own intelligence agencies, is that Iran is not close to developing a nuclear weapon, The IAEA recently reported that they stopped their nuclear weapons program back in 2003. So at this point, there's no evidence that they have the technological capability or the desire to create a nuclear weapon. And from my experience talking to Iranians, people see this as a major point of contention, that the United States has a double standard with its nuclear nonproliferation policy and is telling Iran that they can't enrich uranium, which is a right they technically have under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. So ideally, there would be rigorous inspections of Iran's nuclear program, but at this point, there's no sign that they're an imminent threat to the U.S. or to the U.S.'s allies, and there's plenty of time to pursue diplomacy, and that the nuclear issue should just be one of many issues that's on the table, including stabilizing Iraq, including Afghanistan, all these other issues where we have a mutual interest with Iran.
Let's talk a little bit about sanctions. Who's trying to push sanctions on Iran right now?
Well, right now there are several bills in Congress, one by Representative Howard Berman from Los Angeles and another one in the Senate that's being pushed by Senator Joe Lieberman, amongst others. And these bills are designed to stop any kind of gas imports from getting into Iran. And one of the lead sponsors of a similar bill in the House has openly acknowledged Iranians are going to die if we pass these sanctions. And yet they're still putting them out there because they think that the threat of sanctions or the imposition of sanctions is going to be helpful either in changing the regime's behavior or turning people in Iran against their government. And this is completely counterproductive because, first and foremost, it makes the diplomatic overtures of the Obama administration seem disingenuous to the American people. I actually had a conversation with someone in Tehran, a local businessman who described U.S. policy to me as holding out a carrot but hiding a bottle behind its back, like they're ready to strike against Iran. And that's the perception that people in Iran get when they see the United States offering diplomacy but also threatening all these sanctions. And that's not likely to turn the Iranian people against their government. And in addition, you know, those kind of sanctions, if they are implemented, they hurt the people, they don't hurt the government, and they hurt the pro-democracy movements there. So it's really threatening to undermine the best possibility that we have for diplomacy. Obviously, there are complications with the election results, but essentially the situation is the same as it was before the election, that diplomacy is the only feasible option, and the pressure to pass sanctions in Congress is going to undermine that. So we're really urging people to keep the pressure on Congress, let them know that the public here really wants diplomacy with Iran, and that they need to stop the saber rattling and pressuring for sanctions.
That was Rebecca Griffin, the political director of Peace Action West, an organization working toward nuclear disarmament and diplomacy with Iran. You can see videos and get information at their site, peaceactionwest.org. In the Gaza Strip, scientists and community members are saying that lagoons filled with sewage are creating serious health and environmental problems. But as FSRN's Rami Al-Maghari reports, efforts to build a water treatment plant have been stymied by Israel's tough restrictions on the materials that can be sent into the coastal strip.
More than 5,000 residents of the Amal Nasser village in northern Gaza say they have been affected by the sewage lagoons. Some have worms in their stomachs, others have respiratory problems. Also, agriculture in the village has suffered. Some of these lagoons were created in Amal Nasser by the coastal municipality's water utility in 2007. Sewage water is pumped from the northern towns of Jebalia, Beit Lahia and Beit Hanun into this border area. Rafiq Abu Hashish is a resident of Amal Nasser. He says that most of his 11 children have had health problems since the first sewage lagoons appeared decades ago.
Wallahi, I swear that all my children suffer from worms. Whenever we get them checked, we find out they have worms in their stomachs. Even the elderly suffer from worms too, all because of polluted sewage water lagoons.
Rafiq's relative, Riyadh, who is a father of 10 children, says agricultural crops do not hold up due to the infertility of soil.
There is agriculture, but crops don't survive. I swear by God that we put cucumbers and tomatoes in the refrigerator, and the next morning we find that they've already gone bad. That is really shocking. A refrigerator that is supposed to keep these vegetables fresh turns into making them bad. Of course, this is because of the polluted water. That's what happens.
The existence of such sewage lagoons has also helped to spread skin diseases and respiratory problems for the Bedouin villagers of Umm Al Nasr. Umm Abdulrahman is an elderly woman.
At nighttime, we were unable to bear the putrid stench around us while we have children here. Yesterday night at 10, we moved a three-month-old baby to the clinic because he had acute diarrhea and was vomiting continuously.
Dr. Muhammad Yaghi of the local clinic says an estimated 80 to 90% of the villagers suffer from various health complications.
بالإضافة لهذه الأمراض في برضو يعني منتشرة خاصة في فصل الشتاء يعني بنواجه مشكلة اللي هي الأمراض.
In addition to such diseases, in winter particularly, we face other problems such as upper respiratory infections among children, which are sometimes viral or bacterial. Also, there are cases of asthma resulting from the emanation of poisonous substances from the cesspools around us.
According to the Gaza-based coastal municipality's water utility, the problem became more alarming after the 2007 collapse of a large filtration basin. The collapse caused the death of 5 residents and injured 35 others. It also rendered 60 dwellings completely destroyed and 140 others partially damaged. To fix the problem, local officials started work on a $75 million water treatment plant. But so far, the plant remains incomplete. Work has been held up due to the Israeli closure of the borders and many Israeli restrictions on the entry of raw materials into Gaza. This project is a part of the Quartet Committee's developmental plans for Gaza. The Quartet Committee consists of the US, the United Nations, the European Union, and Russia. Mondar Shiblak is the Director General of Coastal Municipality's Water Utility in Gaza.
This is mainly a civil works, and I was talking about thousands of tons of cement. The other component, which is the pipes, I'm talking about special kind of pipes that are utilized inside the new location. I'm talking about electromechanical equipment, stuff like huge pumps, like treatment facilities. Those are well known for the technical person that could be consulted by the Israeli side in order to give more justification for the need to bring those materials in. I think those issues are clear to the Israeli side. Without the commitment from the Israeli side to let the entry of materials needed for the construction, this project will never see the life.
For more than 2 years now, Israel has been blocking entry of a long list of essential items into Gaza, including cement and pipelines, for what Israel argues is security considerations. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, North in Gaza.
And that will do it for today's newscast. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda.